Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome our guest co-host today, Dr. Laura Gay. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. You know, on our show today, we're having a meaningful conversation with Dr. Clark Hanmer, a family practice physician who was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer in 2015. And we're going to be talking about his moving story and his new book, Dancing with My Cancer Demon. It's a difficult conversation, and he's very brave and has so many good thoughts. I'm looking forward to talking with him. First, though, we're going to talk about some research that matters. And our very first one talks about violence. And is violence like a contagious infection among friends? What are they talking about here?
Yeah, so in the American Journal of Public Health, there's a study that came out of Ohio State that analyzed about 6,000 American students in grades 7 through 12 and looking at really, you know, whether or not the students had friends that had ever hurt anyone and how likely they were to also hurt somebody else. So it's pretty striking data that shows that there, you know, in fact, is a pretty contagious infection with violence and amongst friends.
Yeah. They said if a friend had pulled a weapon on someone, the youth they interviewed were 140% more likely to have pulled a weapon. And if a friend of theirs had been involved in a serious fight, they were 48% more likely to have been in a serious fight. Male students alone, the likelihood of hurting someone rose 82% for each additional friend who had seriously hurt someone. This is worrisome.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if you remember all those mall fights that recently broke out around the holidays, but I think this really speaks to that and very, very scary.
I know as a parent, when my kids were growing up, if there was a friend of theirs who was getting in trouble, I was worried. This kind of says I should be worried about those sorts of things. And they said that it could spread up to 4 degrees. So, you know, it does not just that first friend, but the friend of the friend of the friend of the friend, which actually is a large number of potential friends here. I just think it's one of the questions that we might ask when we're in the examination room, when we're doing a physical on a teenager. We might find out that do they have any of their close friends that has been in fights or has, you know, weapons or other things that put them at great risk?
Yeah, absolutely. Teens are very impressionable. So if we can help them in any way, we certainly need to.
Yeah, and this also suggests that we might be able to identify it earlier and maybe some other strategies that might even prevent violence. Really like it. Our next research that matters is, what is the risk of certain fruits choking those who may be eating them, like grapes? What do you think? Do you think about this at all?
You know, I have given my nephews and nieces grapes many times without cutting them up. I hope their parents aren't listening to me now. But
do you say open your mouth and you throw them into their mouth?
No, I do that to myself, though.
Yeah, you throw them up in the air.
Yep.
Probably not a good idea.
Party trick,
this research, right?
Yeah, based on this research, looking at cutting up grapes and how that can help prevent choking hazards, especially in kids less than age 5. According to the American Academy of Pediatrics, grapes are the third most common cause following hot dogs and candy.
Yeah, you oftentimes hear that, you know, don't let your child suck on a piece of candy. Even someone who has dementia who's older, that you could swallow, but I don't think we think about so much, you know, about eating grapes. Oh, they could chew the grape, or even hot dogs, which I don't eat hot dogs, so I hadn't thought about that, but sounds like that could be a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, the perfect size that it can block off the airway. So cutting them into smaller pieces can be life-saving.
And it's probably not just grapes and hot dogs and candy. I bet a piece of cantaloupe or a piece of pineapple that could just as easily be stuck in there, a piece of mango, anything that's kind of a hard, something that's not cut up smaller, certainly could do that. An apple could do it, though I don't think people swallow apples too much. But the point here is an ounce of prevention might be worth a pound of cure.
Absolutely.
What's our very next research that matters? Laura.
Yeah, so this is an interesting study that came out looking at indoor tanning beds and surprising a new at-risk group for skin cancer.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought about this at all. First off, I don't know of any doctor today who's advising indoor tanning. And let's be fessed up, I've never done indoor tanning. Have you done it?
I have to say I spent a lot of time in the tanning bed during my teenage years.
Oh, my goodness gracious. So this research is probably really interesting to you because it's probably not what you were expecting.
Absolutely not. It's actually saying that the rates of use of an indoor tanning bed are about the same in a population that's kind of surprising. It's the non-heterosexual black male teens were found to be nearly equal to that of heterosexual white females.
It's not just about tanning. It's about the experience. It's about for people who do tanning that they can get release of endogenous opioids and the way they can make them feel. And so among certain groups, and in this particular case, the sexual minority males, they're using tanning and they can actually have very high rates of skin cancer.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's been a lot of regulation around tanning beds recently, and for good reason. You know, certainly it increases your rates of skin cancer tremendously, especially, you know, even more than just laying out in the sun.
And I think, you know, if you're taking care of certain populations or you're a parent of certain groups, you really have to understand there may be some psychological distress, and the psychological distress or prejudice or victimization may cause you to do things. And in this case, it might be tanning as a way of coping. And so at least let's open up that door and offer other ways and listening and understanding that might maybe lead to less of the tanning.
Absolutely.
Yes. Let's talk about our very last research that matters. And it's actually about a study that's near and dear to me, in part because my lab actually did this research that's on cigars. And I can tell you about it, but I you know, wonder, you must see people who use cigars. And what is your perception of how they think about cigars?
Yeah, so I think, you know, a lot of people who do smoke cigars, I think it's not necessarily an everyday occurrence. So a lot of them think that because it's not every day and they don't feel like they're quote-unquote addicted to it, they often think that cigars are not as dangerous as cigarette smoking would be. So yeah, this is a really interesting study looking at how adolescents look at cigar smoking and the risk of cigar smoking. Yeah, so I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, we were really curious. There are new warnings that are being mandated on cigar products, and we were interested in terms of how adolescents might perceive these because no one had ever studied warnings on cigar products. And we were also concerned that adolescents in particular might think cigars are a safe alternative versus one of the warnings is that they are not a safe alternative. We thought they may not think that it can cause lung cancer and heart disease when we know they can cause lung cancer and heart disease. And we thought that they may not think that they can cause cancers of the mouth and throat because they would say they don't inhale. But even if they don't inhale, they can cause it. So these are what the warnings are about. And we did a nationwide survey of adolescents, and we actually found that for two of the three warnings, including the cigars are not a safe alternative to cigarettes and that cigar smoking cause cancers of the mouth and throat, even if you don't inhale, these were really not as believable to these adolescents. They did believe the one about lung cancer and heart disease, which is to suggest that we've got a long way to go because adolescents are at a time in which, you know, they're experimenting, and this could be a gateway for many of them, particularly because cigar smoking has this aura of, you know, success, and you see it on TV and you see it in movies and usually associated with things that are happening that are good.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, wonderful research, very well done. You know, I think it's important. The most important thing is that, you know, all tobacco is bad tobacco, whether it be in a cigar or in a cigarette. And you know, I think we as a society need to come to terms with that.
Well, hopefully the Food and Drug Administration, who's really sponsoring this research and doing other research on warnings, they're moving to not only have these text warnings that may be more factual and stronger, but they could also make them larger and make these graphic warnings so that you could show the impact of these, would hopefully persuade many youth not to ever start them. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we're going to be doing a special interview for the next three segments of our show with Dr. Clark Hanmer, a family practice physician who was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer in 2015, and about his journey and his new book, Dancing with My Cancer Demon. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Laura Gay. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Laura Gay. Today on Conversations, Laura, we're talking with Dr. Clark Hanmer, a longtime family practice physician who was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer in 2015, about his story and his new book, Dancing with My Cancer Demon. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Hanmer.
Well, thank you.
You know, it's really a privilege to be talking with a fellow family physician. And I know we're going to spend most of the time talking about your journey, which took you to unexpected places and still is. But I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about you and how you ended up becoming a family physician.
I'm originally from Michigan. Spent 18 years in Big Rapids, where all the doctors there said, we need more people seers. So I went to Michigan State for undergrad and Wayne State for medical school. So imagine going to inner city Detroit shortly after the riots to become a rural family doc. So with that, I attained a two-year scholarship with the National Health Service, which committed me to a rural practice. And I spent a lot of time getting rotations that put me in rural locations. Did an internship in Wisconsin, second 2 years in Fayetteville, North Carolina with a Duke AHEC family practice residency. The second year of that, I spent a lot of time going to DuPont County, working with the Office of Rural Health to develop a, quote, new model of primary care. So we developed new charts and billing systems. Went to Hamilton, Pennsylvania for 6 years. There was an affiliated residency with Jefferson College. So I got the bug for teaching, ended up as a residency associate director for 3 years, quality director of a 1,000-bed hospital for 5 years, went back to Wisconsin and directed the family practice department at Gunderson, migrated back to North Carolina as my wife got a job in teaching. She's a biologist.
Well, we're glad you came back to North Carolina. The patients and providers have benefited.
Yeah, so we, you know, in hearing your story, you've had this long career as a doctor, and you said kind of overnight you transformed from being a doctor to becoming a patient. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what that transformation was like and where you are now?
Well, the news I got from my cancer was there is no cure, no known combination of radiation, surgery, chemo that we know of that's going to cure you. So I'm 15 months into this. And if you look at life expectancy tables, I'm at about the median point of dying at this stage. Almost no one makes it 2 years. When I got the news, I said, well, it's going to take me a couple months to close my solo practice. And the surgeon looked at me and said, no, a couple weeks. And that really struck me hard. With that, we wrote letters to about 800 patients, closed the practice over 2 months, delayed chemo until that was done. And since then, I've had no patients, a lot of time on my hands, so that's how the book happened. And I've evolved over time kind of thinking about, well, I know something about cancer, but I'm not a specialist. I have to be really careful not to direct them. When they start to raise a suggestion, I have to kind of bite my tongue, be careful not to overplay my hand, and really lean on them for advice and what's the best course time to time. The same is true with nurses. They really, in the hospital, are the backbone of care. And if you get on the wrong side of one, I think it'd be a bad week.
You talk about in your book, and I want to talk some about this, but you talk about one of the things you were kind of most proud about from your time as being a doctor is the ability to put together the stories of taking care of people, the narrative. Talk to us in an era of electronic medical records, how you see that perhaps as a legacy that you really want to pass on to maybe other providers, maybe patients too.
Well, I'm on the fence about that. One of my patients called me Marcus Welby with a computer. And so I really come from the Marcus Welby era of comprehensive, continuous care from cradle to grave. I delivered babies for 11 years. Now I'm a geriatrician. So my practices have evolved as I've aged. I spent 1 year installing software for a computer company, and I thought I knew what doctors needed. It turned out when I used the same software in my office, it was written upside down and backwards. And so I really spent a decade trying to make it right, because not every patient walks in the room with the same order of business. A laceration of the hand is not the same as my mom died last night. And your description of things are very different. So what I've really worked on is how to get the important things about the person to the top of the chart so you never forget those. What I found in becoming a patient is as you move from institution to institution, they have no clue what's in the EMR. They're not transferable. And even within their own institution, there's often errors and it's hard to find information. So what I developed was a one-button history and physical for myself initially, how to get a patient into the emergency room and admitted without starting all over. And that became my transfer record for patients as they left my practice. And then it became my communication tool as I went from doctor to doctor, hospital to hospital. And everywhere I went, it's a marvelous thing. They've never seen anything like it before.
Well, it sounds like, you know, you're an expert on communication. Tell us a little bit about how did you communicate the tough news to your loved ones?
As we came out of the hospital and were driving home, it's a two-hour drive, I decided to call my sister and give her the news. And I just about killed her. She wailed and no, this can't be, and hollered and cried. And what I realized is there's no way to reach out and hold hands on the phone. And there was no way to interrupt her. So when I got home, I wrote an email and sent it to the rest of my family and let them sit on that for a couple of days. And then I called them. And the conversations were much easier. Mm. So with the practice, I decided to write the same letter, essentially. The first line was, have a seat. I've got some bad news. And then told them the circumstances, what the disease was, what the prognosis was, and what we needed to do in the next few weeks. And it turned out that was really a smart way to go. I sent the same letter to the hospital, all the medical staff. And what I found was there's a wide range of reactions to that letter. Some people could kind of care less. They've had lots of doctors over the years. And other people grieved. They reported in that they cried for a week straight. They couldn't sleep. There are all sorts of expressions of emotion through that.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we come back, I'd like to pick up on perhaps some experiences that you talk about in your book about resilience and what you learn from your patients, what you learn from your own experience. We'll take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. Clark Hanmer, a family practice physician, about his moving story and his book, Dancing with My Cancer Demon. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Laura Gay.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Laura Gay. We've been talking with Dr. Clark Hanmer, a family practice physician who was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer in 2015, about his new book, Dancing with My Cancer Demon. And right before the break, Dr. Hanmer, you really were talking about some really remarkable lessons of kind of a one-touch medical history and physical summary to patients, and that you can communicate and starting to share communicating to your family and patients about your diagnosis. And what comes through in the conversation, and then also what you talk about in the book, is resilience. And I wonder if you might share how you came to think about resilience, and both in patients and your approach to your cancer diagnosis.
Well, it first came to mind when I was interviewed for a research protocol on the subject, and I hadn't really thought of it as a patient quality before. To give you an idea of what I consider as a resilient patient, I had one woman in her 70s, very large woman, osteoarthritis, and she presented one day with pain all over and a low-grade fever. After about 3-4 days in the hospital, we discovered salmonella infection in her artificial knee in her right side. It had been there for 15 years. And it turned out after we shipped her up to the university, she also had an infection of her aorta and spinal cord. They did surgery to decompress the spine. She became paraplegic, lost control of her bladder and legs. About, I don't know, a year, they shipped her back to us for care. Within a couple, 3 weeks, she dehisced her spine wound again, had a bladder infection, and we sent her back to the university. She had some difficult adult children, one of whom had hallucinations and was schizophrenic, and another daughter now that was taking care of her at home. And I'd periodically get letters about her and her progress. And she eventually healed up with a lot of rehab. And the last time I saw her, she was walking with a walker, cooking for her family. She's the sort of person that was always grateful, put her faith in her doctors and in God, and was sure she was going to pull through. The flip side for her is what I call a non-resilient patient. These are people that have what you consider a setback, but it shouldn't be that great. One was a woman who, in her mid-50s, came home to find that her husband was in his recliner and had died of a heart attack that afternoon. And it took her 2 years to go into the bedroom at the insistence of her sister. And I would say it took her 5 years to get any semblance of a normal life back. Had she had some sort of cancer in those 5 years, there would have been no way to really help her except by protocol. So it's a difference, I think, in emotional adjustment and sense of self and maybe sense of purpose that sets it apart. In my own case, I looked at this a lot because people keep seeming to say that I'm resilient. And what I came to the conclusions were that I owned the problem. So as soon as cancer came up, I said, yep, got it. I have my feet on the ground, head clear, realistic, interested in learning how to deal with it. And I'm curious, active, seeking new information. And that led me to clinical trials. I think I still have my feet on the ground. And then there's a sense of continuity to what's going on, that I'm not alone in all this. There's been lots of people behind me. There'll be people coming in the future facing same issues. So The best thing I can do is lay down my experience and hope they can gain something from it.
Any advice you can give to their caregivers to try to help patients become more resilient?
Well, I think it's probably a series of life events. Some people, you know, are just fearful from the beginning, and the future looks terrible. And if you can help them reframe that, for many people, they're stuck on the past. Something happened that they just can't let go of. And one simple line is the past is past. We can't change that. All we can do is to try to understand it and make better decisions from there. So it's, I guess, a view I have of past, present, future. And we live in the present, and we ought to do what we can do with what we have and make the best of things.
You know, one example I'd love you to just spend a minute or two and tell us about is, and I first became really aware of some of the remarkable things that you were doing with your time, which was a grand rounds on medical ethics at the NIH, where they actually had a patient there talking to them and helping them understand things they hadn't understood before. I found it remarkable. Tell us about it.
If I see a problem, I tend to address it. So one of the problems I have is there's only 4,000 of us cholangiocarcinomas a year. And if you don't get treatment, half of you are dead in 6 months. And the requirement for most studies is that you take standard treatment before you get experimental treatment. Well, standard treatment is chemotherapy, and that takes you, I don't know, 3-4 months to prove that it didn't work well enough that you can qualify. And so it appeared to me that at least half of us couldn't make it to the NIH if we knew about it. So I wrote a letter into the ethics committee. It's a consultation service. After I picked up one of their books in their gift shop, which had 50 case reports, and I wasn't in there. They found my letter absolutely right on, and the next clinic visit I had, 5 people showed up to spend an hour and a half with me and my wife talking about who we are and why I sent the letter. That led to a national phone conference that happens monthly among the ethicists, and generated a paper, and then an invitation to become Grand Rounds in October. The expert they brought in came from Harvard, and hematology oncologist. He basically agreed with me, and it turned out at Harvard, at least in his office, patients get choices. You can get the chemotherapy, you can get the experimental therapy, you can get nothing, you can get both. And that's been their standard for a couple of years. So it generated a lot of interest. I don't know that it'll change the IRB's decision at this point.
The Institutional Review Boards. It may not change them, but it changes us.
Correct.
Well, when we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. Clark Handmer, a family physician who's diagnosed with stage 4 cancer in 2015. About his touching story and his new book, Dancing with My Cancer Demon. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Laura Gay.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and myself, Dr. Laura Gay. We've been talking with Dr. Clark Handmer, a family doctor who's diagnosed with stage 4 cancer in 2015, about his moving story and his new book, Dancing with My Cancer Demon. Do you mind telling us a little bit about what your inspiration was for the book?
Well, it wasn't an inspiration. As I was closing my practice, I had a patient come in and ask me Dr. Hanmer, if you close your practice, how are we going to keep up with your progress? That was a really good question. The next day, a lady came in and told me the story about her sister with breast cancer and how they had used caringbridge.org as an online journal to communicate with a wide family. So I tried it and very quickly ended up promising my audience that I'd post something every Sunday. And that kept a lot of people in the loop. People can comment on the, I'd put a post up and they'd comment. And over time, that the direction of my book changed based on their feedback. And it turned out they liked the doctor stories a lot more than my personal health stories. So much for cancer. I do have a little sense of humor, so a lot of people find the book funny, which is a little odd when you're talking about death and dying. And about halfway through, one of my wife's colleagues is an English professor. He'd been reading along. He'd been a patient of mine. And he thought this was a unique writing experience. He'd never seen a book evolve in such a manner and was more than happy to edit it for me for free. I could do this online. There's ways to get self-published without any cost. So I signed up and did it. So it wasn't really a, I think I'll write a book project. It was a, I think I'll communicate with my friends. And it evolved in that manner.
Why is it dancing? Where did that word come from?
Well, I read an article from the New England Journal about communication in cancer. And in particular, in childhood cancers, the word fighting is a difficult one for them. And most people frame cancer treatment as fighting the disease. For the kids, they use the word work. We're going to work on this. And you can work on something, but you don't necessarily fail. If you fight and fail, that's a morale downer for both the patient and the family. So I was looking for some other metaphor for cancer, and through the book we had a title contest, what should this thing be named, and demon came up, and demon as something that's internal, part of me, it's not something I like to fight, I just soon get along with, and in my case I know I'm not going to defeat it, so we're having a dance of and we're going to see if we can learn some new steps.
Well, one of the steps that comes through clear in your book, Dancing with My Cancer Demon, is faith. Tell us a little bit about the meaning of faith, perhaps how it's changed for you, and then I know you have something you'd like to share with us, a piece of writing.
Yeah. Well, I think if I read the devotional, you'll understand me better. Very early on this, like at the two-week mark, my pastor asked me to write a devotional for the annual Advent book for the church. And I said, what's that? And he says, oh, it's simple. You have a Bible verse, story, and then a prayer. I said, sure, I'll be happy to. He said, great, it's due Wednesday. So I sent him a draft, and he says, that's great, we'll publish it. He put it at the front of the book, and the book required a couple, three extra printings from what they were ever used to. So looking at it, I am consistently that person that wrote that, November 1st, 2015. But by the grace of God, I am what I am. 1 Corinthians 15:10. By now you probably know I have gallbladder cancer, which has spread to my liver. No known treatment, 10% chance of living another year. Wham! Abrupt turn of fortune. Time to face death and dying, as have my ancestors before me. I have time to make some preparations. For that I am glad. Lots of people coming forth with stories of folks who beat cancer after the doctors had given up, most by some act of faith or atonement, one out of anger, another just because she decided she didn't want to die yet. Lots of people gently questioning my faith. Is it strong enough or of the right type? We can fix that if you let us. Truth is, I do not know if there is an afterlife. Have not seen it. Have not spent my life pursuing it. Rather, in my teens and 20s, I decided to do my part to build heaven here on earth, now, in this life, to make this a better place. I approached this religious thing as a student. I dated a girl from a fundamentalist family. I debated the Jehovah's Witness at the door. I spent a summer sharing a room with a missionary in a Chicago ghetto. I watched an abortion as a medical student. I dissected the body of a man donated to science. I served as a medical examiner and documented the cruelty we can have for one another. Medicine is complicated. You need to have your feet on the ground, head clear, heart open, willing to listen. I set up my rules early on to accept others where they are spiritually, to live within the law, to live ethically, to not compromise my personal integrity. Am I perfect? Am I without sin? No. I am human and am my share of mistakes to atone for. So what is a good Christian to do for a poor soul like me? Please, live your faith. I welcome your prayers. I am humbled by your collective gifts of compassion and hope.
It is as it is. We are who we are. Celebrate life. Help one another while you are able. The prayer. Dear Lord, may those who know me find peace and understanding in my passing.
Thank you, Dr. Hamner. Ms. Hamner, thank you for sharing that. That's really, really amazing and really, really appreciate it. As we think and reflect on the devotional and our talk today, I wonder if there's one final thought you might like to leave your listeners, your supporters, your fans, your patients with.
Final? I'm not done yet.
That's the message. Yeah, we always say on our show one final one because our show wraps up. But I think yours is the story's not finished being told.
Right. Yeah, so I'm working on the epilogue. Try to write the chapter after you die, before.
Well, I know we're going to put a bookmark. Really appreciate your time, Ms. Hamner, your time. We've been talking with Dr.
Appreciate the honor.
Oh, it's our honor.
It's our honor, entirely. Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
We've been talking with Dr. Clark Hamner, a family practice physician, about his story with cancer and his book, Dancing with My Cancer Demon. You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Laura Gay. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.